89% of business leaders say AI is a top priority, according to research by Boston Consulting Group. The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. With top-tier security credentials and 15 years of experience in responsible AI, Grammarly is how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. See why 70,000 teams trust Grammarly at grammarly.com/enterprise.
Open source AI is available to all, not just the few. Meta's open source is free to use, enabling startups like Rightsy to innovate. Here's CEO and co-founder Brandon Mitchell.
We use Llama, Meta's free open source AI model, to build Job Search Genius, an AI tool that helps candidates write their resume, practice mock interviews, and learn salary negotiation tactics.
Learn how others are building with Meta's free open source AI at ai.meta.com/open. Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Joe Weisenthal.
So Joe, we recently recorded an episode with Kevin Muir where we were talking about concentration risk in stock indices and I guess historical analogies with the dot-com bubble of the 2000s. And I know that this is one of your favorite subjects. I think I said it was like your own personal catnip.
That's right.
And so I thought, you know what? I did not get Joe a Christmas present this year. In fact, I don't think I've ever gotten you a Christmas present. But wouldn't it be nice if I got him a whole episode where we're talking to one of the world's most famous investors who correctly called the internet bubble?
Let's do it. Let's jump right into it. No more intro. I'm so thrilled about this conversation. Let's just get it started.
All right. I will also admit this is a belated Christmas present to myself as well. So we are going to be speaking with Howard Marks. He is, of course, the co-founder and co-chair of Oaktree Capital Management. He's famously a credit investor, but he did call, as I said, the dot-com bubble correctly. So Howard, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tracy, and also Joe.
Maybe just to begin with, give us some context around what the early 2000s, late 1990s were like for you. What were you doing and what were you observing at that time?
Well, the 1990s were a slow time for credit investors. We're kind of opportunistic and bargain hunters. And bargains come from dislocations and, you know, people feeling urgency to get out of positions. And the 90s were generally a placid period, except for the around 98, we had a devaluation of the Russian ruble and a Southeast Asian crisis. And we had the meltdown of a highly levered hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management. But those were all kind of idiosyncratic events, not macro and not broad-based. Other than that, the investment environment was placid. Importantly, it was the best decade in history, I think, for stocks. And the S&P 500 rose an average of 20% a year for 10 years, which is an astronomical, an astronomical accomplishment. If you rise 20% a year for 10 years, I would guess that something goes up roughly eight times in 10 years, which is incredible. And of course, this was all powered by the what we call the TMT bubble, tech, media, and telecom bubble. Some people call it the internet bubble, which prevailed in 98, 99, and into 2000. So it was hot times, not for credit investors, hot times for equity investors.
You know, you recently wrote a memo that called back to a memo that you had written basically exactly 25 years ago. So right at the start of 2000, of course, the dot-com bubble or the TMT bubble peaked, I think it was in March of that year. You got the timing right. And that's sort of extraordinary because there were a lot of people probably starting in 1998 and 1999, maybe even earlier, who were like, this is ridiculous. There's all these companies, they literally don't have a penny in earnings or perhaps don't even have a penny in revenue. They just have the name .com in their name. They IPO at crazy prices. What is the experience like? I mean, that was very fortunate timing on your part, but there were a lot of people who, you know, were famously correct and early, and they had clients abandon them and so forth. And they were thought as like, oh, you don't understand the new paradigm, et cetera. What's that like in the years before that, as it feels like the market is becoming increasingly untethered from any sort of reality, and yet there's no payoff in being correct?
Right. Well, there's so much to say in response to your question. You know, I use a lot of quotes and adages in when I write, because, you know, other people have said things so much better than we can. And one of the first adages I learned in the early 70s was that being too far ahead of your time is indistinguishable from being wrong. So, yeah, it's painful to say something and predict something and then have to wait years and years for it to come true. Alan Greenspan famously said, I think it was in 96, that we're beginning to see signs of irrational exuberance in the stock market. And of course, the market went straight up for the next 4 years. And, you know, there are people who pronounced that we were in a stock market bubble. I think I can think of one in June of 2020. And here we are almost 5 years later.
Yeah.
And of course, we did stall out in 22. But if you went out in 20 and weren't smart enough to come back in 22, you've missed a big ride. So I think, well, you know, one thing I argue strenuously, Joe, is that in the investment business, there's no place for certainty. And Mark Twain said, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for certain that just ain't true. And so you can have opinions, but you should never be certain that you're right. And you should never arrange your financial affairs on the assumption that your forecast is right, because it can be right intellectually or factually or rationally, but just take a long time to materialize. And if you can't survive between when you take your position and when your expectation comes true, then obviously it's not something you should do. And one of my colleagues once wrote a note to his clients. He says, if you name a price, don't name a date. And if you name a date, don't name a price.
So that's good advice for journalists too. Yeah.
But anybody who names a price and a date is probably going to get carried out of it sooner or later. Hmm.
So what was it like then when you hit the publish button on the note? I think it was called bubble.com and you published it. I think it was right at the start of January 1st. What was it? 2000.
It was January 2nd, 2000. It was the first business day of 2000.
And then stocks peaked later that month, right?
Yeah. No, I think a little later that year. Joe said it was in March. I don't remember exactly. I thought it was a little later than that. But you know, I'd started writing these memos in 1990. I've been writing for 10 years. Of course, in those days, they went out in the mail and to a limited audience, just my clients. And, you know, for 10 years, I never had a response. And then I spent the fall of 99 working on this memo, bubble.com, and was ready to push the button. I guess I polished it over Christmas probably and sent it out the first day. And, you know, let me just clarify one thing for the record and for the benefit of the listeners. If you read that memo, it does not predict the bubble. And it does not say, you know, the market's going to collapse. All it did is describe the current conditions. And that's two different things. Now, I don't make predictions. I only describe current conditions. And my motto is, we never know where we're going, but we sure as hell ought to know where we are. And I believe, you know, this is a little bit of a matter of semantics. I believe that where we are, if we properly assess it, informs where we're going. But I think people who waste their time figuring out, making predictions, which I'm strongly against, are wasting their time. I think that describing current conditions can be done accurately and obviously has an impact on what the future holds. So, as I say, read the memo. I think it reads well in retrospect, but don't expect to find a place where I say get out of the market or the market's going to collapse or we're in a bubble that's going to pop. what I say there is, I just want to call your attention to all these forms of excessive or overheated behavior and let you know what I think is going on. That's all it says.
So in the art of just identifying where we are, and when we're talking about financial markets, obviously we can use all kinds of ratios, et cetera, you know, price to earnings, price to forward earnings, valuations, a million different ratios that you can come up with. And then, you know, there are sort of cultural markers. And I remember in summer 99, I would get lunch every day at the same pizza shop, and the pizza shop owner had CNBC on and he was trading tech stocks at the time. And these other sort of indicators that people are just excited about the prospect of making money and making money fast. And when you do an assessment and you say, okay, here's where we are, how much do you sort of hew strictly to the math, so to speak, and how do you systematically incorporate other indicators of exuberance, which perhaps can't always be captured on a Bloomberg terminal, for example?
No, look, I think you're absolutely on the right track, Joe. You read the memo. My observations are, I would say, 99% what you called cultural markers, which I think is great, or behavioral indicators, and 1% math. And to me, it's the behavior that is so indicative. And in my first book, which is called The Most Important Thing, I have something in there called The Poor Man's Guide to Market Assessment. And it really takes mostly cultural markers and puts them in two columns, left and right. And whichever column is prevailing, it tells you something. And for example, I say in there that if people like me are being invited to cocktail parties and are the center of attention and so forth, then it probably means that investing has been doing well and everybody's optimistic about it. And it indicates that maybe things are too hot. And if people like me are not invited or shunted off to the corner, maybe the markets are too cold, too cheap, and it's time to strike. So I think that these behavioral indicators are extremely important. And I wrote a memo in, I think it was the summer of 23, called Taking the Temperature. And I describe what I do in this regard as taking the temperature of the market to figure out if it's hot or cold. And when I was working on my second book, which is called Mastering the Market Cycle, and I was speaking with my son, Andrew, who's a venture capitalist, I said to him, you know, I think my forecasts over the course of my career have been about right. And he says to me, yeah, Dad, that's because you did it 5 times in 50 years. 5 times in 50 years, I found the market either so crazy high or crazy low that you could make a logical case that was either overextended or too cheap, and you could do so with a high degree of confidence. And I recount the 5 times I did it and why. But you know, if I had tried to do it 500 times or 5,000 times in my career, I've probably been in the investment business for about almost 20,000 days. If I tried to do it 5,000 times every fourth day, you know, I'd probably be 50-50 at best. So to me, it's noting extremes of behavior. And that's what I was doing with bubble.com, and that's what I did in the 5 other observations.
Percent of business leaders say AI is a top priority, according to research by Boston Consulting Group. But with AI tools popping up everywhere, how do you separate the helpful from the hype? The right choice is crucial, which is why teams at Fortune 500 companies use Grammarly. With over 15 years of experience building responsible, secure AI, Grammarly isn't just another AI communication assistant. It's how companies like yours increase productivity while keeping data protected and private. Designed to fit the needs of business, Grammarly is backed by a user-first privacy policy and industry-leading security credentials.
This means you won't have to worry about the safety of your company information. Grammarly also emphasizes responsible AI so your company can avoid harmful bias.